And so it was like, I promise we'll keep treat everything. Just, you know, we won't damage anything. It'll be fine. Cute cut to us coming in the next day with barrels of Hershey's syrup.
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Barrett Scher.
Hello.
Today we have very special guests, writers, directors, Matt Mercer and Mike Teston. They have a movie called Dementia Part 2, coming out in theaters May 21st, and VOD, digital, and DVD on June 1st. Matt and Mike, welcome.
Hey, thanks Hello. For having us.
Yeah, absolutely. So this movie was made under some kind of unusual circumstances. Am I correct?
Yeah, that would be absolutely correct. Yeah, it was made on a dare, basically.
Oh, yeah, a dare.
Yeah, I guess we can. I'll try to
tell me all of this.
I'll try to nutshell this as best as I can. I was at a film festival in the UK called Frightfest UK, and I ran into a producer that Mike and I both have worked with in the past, J.D. Lifshitz, and he had just had a beer with a guy named Josh Goldblum, and Josh Goldblum runs a film festival in Chicago called Cinepocalypse.
Yo, hold on. This sounds like the beginning of Ant-Man when Michael Pena is doing his rundown of like the people that know the people, the people that know the people.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. See, it's already too complicated. But basically Josh has this film festival and he had an empty slot and he dared JD to make a movie in the 5 weeks leading up to the festival. So basically when the festival announced their schedule, we were allowed to start production. So JD asked Mike and I to make a film. And the only thing, I guess the only rule was it had to be called Dementia Part 2. And Mike had made the original, the first Dementia.
Yeah. And it had to be a genre film.
Yeah. So we had, I think we started when they announced the lineup of the schedule of the festival and we, you know, wrote it in 3 days or something, maybe 5 days, 3 or 5 days, prepped for a week and shot the movie in 5 days and finished cutting it in about 3 weeks. I mean, whatever. It was about 30 to 35 days. We made the entire thing from zero. Yeah. From zero to finish.
Oh my God. That's insane. And from what I understand, Dementia Part 2 is different tonally from the first one. I wasn't able to see the first one, so.
Yeah, it's a completely different film. I mean, the first one's sort of a more straightforward psychological thriller, and this one's, you know, the exact opposite of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's like the first one's a dramatic thriller, and this one we aimed for total midnight movie, total gross out type of thing on a budget.
It's almost like the difference between Troll and Troll 2, right? Like does this have any thematic similarities at all?
That's exactly what we were aiming for, yeah.
Oh, really? Good.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if we were thinking of the Troll movies. I guess loosely kind of like the Evil Dead movies, even though the first Evil Dead has some comedy in it. It's taken more seriously. And I think Sam Raimi was aiming for something a little more serious. But then in the second one, he had the whole Three Stooges, you know, the Three Stooges aspects were really amplified. Not that we went for Three Stooges, but we aimed for a much more broadly comedic approach, and I think our sort of touchstones were Evil Dead 2 and Peter Jackson's Dead Alive.
Mm-hmm.
Any Roger Corman movie from the 60s that was made in 3 to 4 days.
Yeah. How are you able to wrangle up a cast to be in this movie that was going to shoot for such a short amount of time, such a you know, specific amount of time? Obviously, Matt, you're in it.
That was key.
Yes. But you have a couple of other actors in here and you know, all of them bring something to this movie that's that's very funny to me, or unique and interesting. And but so how did you get them?
I mean, these were all people that we've each of us have worked with multiple times, so it was all you know, kind of roping friends in for, you know, 5 days of having fun and winging it on a goofy movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the approach was, you know, Mike and I have worked together on about, I don't know, 10 or 11 films, now, feature films now at this point. Mike is a cinematographer by trade, obviously also directs. I started as an actor and now work as an editor a lot. So we have all these different skills we've had to acquire because of budgets in the past,
yeah,
and things, or we've just aimed to acquire. I mean, Mike went to school for his skills, but anyway, yeah, we've made all these movies, and a lot of these actors are people we know, and we felt that because we had to make the movie so fast, it made sense to bring in friends who we, number one, knew would understand the tone, and also would just have fun with us and want to jump in like that, because I don't think any of them got the script until the night before. I think we finished the script and said, we start tomorrow. I mean, even Graham, I called the day before I needed him. Graham Skipper, who's in the movie, I called him the day before I needed him and said, here's the script. You're in 14 pages toward the end of the movie. And he's like, all right, cool. When do we shoot? Tomorrow. He's like, okay, well, what are you shooting tomorrow? All of your stuff. So it was like half a day with Graham, and then that was it. So,
to be fair, like, I don't even know if Graham's character existed until 2 days before. I mean, I'm not sure, but
yeah, the character went through some incarnations. I think he was originally some sort of weird neo-Nazi, and then he's still sort of, and ultimately landed on a weird sort of a Dennis Franz greaseball.
Yeah.
And
also just the idea that, you know, we all probably assume that this would play once it's an apocalypse and that would be done with it.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of like a hangout and have fun and, you know, see what we could come up with.
Yeah. I'll tell you who does an amazing job considering, I mean, and not just considering the circumstances, that makes it sound like I'm letting some things go, but Suzanne Voss is amazing in this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like to be able to create these characterizations and something that and it's a character that has a broad range of emotions, and of course has dementia and everything, and is having to switch from being super nice to super horny, maybe to angry, to all these different things all at once. What is it like hormones. Working with? Yeah, what is it like working with Suzanne Voss?
Well, it's a joy. I've worked with her as an actor several times. I think I was in a movie called Contracted Phase 2, where she played my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
And she
foul-mouthed grandmother,
a foul-mouthed grandmother, which was partially a precursor to this. Mike had worked with her even before that, when on a short film you directed, right?
Yeah, I guess it was just through general casting. I mean, found her for this short I made called The Salesman, where she sort of plays this sort of a dementia afflicted woman. Woman who confuses a door-to-door salesman with her son, and things kind of go awry from there. But she was so great to work with, and then I think from there the next time I worked with her was Contracted too. I don't know if I worked with her in between that.
Okay, before. I mean, you're right that she is amazing in the film, and she, you know, like everybody else, got the script, the final version of the script, the day before. And I don't think I told her that we were even making the film until 5 days before. And I said, do you have time? And she said, well, I'm working. So we did have to work around her schedule, her day job schedule, but we knew she'd be great because she's so, such a facile actor, and also really understood the tone and knew, I mean, she does, you know, like everybody else, she didn't require much direction at all and came up with a lot of things on her own too. Like the, you know, spoiler alert, but she's, you know, there's a scene where she's messing with some intestines.
Oh my God. I'm definitely asking you a question about that.
I think that's the first time we've said that sentence on this, this broadcast is she's messing with some intestines.
Yeah. But her whole, yeah. Glad we could break new ground. But she, you know, she came up with the whole beat at the end of that, where she's turns back to being kind of herself and being apologetic. That was all her, and I just thought that was so funny. And she took it, you know, she understood the tone of the movie, but also took the character very seriously and the dementia very seriously. So she's amazing.
I was talking about this scene with Barrett before you guys came on. There's a absolutely dynamite punchline to that scene, and that is she's got this, you know, she's got this tube of intestine in her mouth, and she looks up at these two people looking back, and she's like, oh no, I've been discovered, and she lets the intestine go and it slaps back on the body and everything. So you're telling me that was kind of almost, well, like she either thought of that or that was like a happy accident.
She thought of the beat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's and sort then, of a mix in there because mm-hmm. some of that's scripted, but I think what wasn't scripted was just her reaction of, oh wait, I'm human,
mm-hmm. right?
I'm in an intestine.
Yeah, and then once someone comes up with an idea like a great idea like that, like Suzanne did, you then start to riff on it. Everyone's right. Like, oh, that's great, and I think either Mike or I said, yeah, and then you can really pull on that intestine and pull as high as you can and it'll slap back. And then I think in the edit, I added a rubber band, like a stretching sound, because I mean, the part of the fun of this movie, some of the most fun I had was the sound design. So yeah, you add that plus her apologetic. I mean, it all gets back to the Jackson Raimi, Sam Raimi kind
Looney
of,
Tunes.
Yeah, Looney Tunes, you know, sound design.
Yeah, it just it's an absolute like just delight seeing that that
part. Good. Cool.
You guys are both co-directors on this, so like how did that work? How did you guys manage directing? Why did you guys feel like you needed to have two directors on this? What was the and how do you guys work together?
I think we just kind of wanted to do something together, and this was an easy way to go into that, because it was just started as strictly a for fun thing that was, you know, going to screen once, we thought. So it was sort of a no risk, you know, just go have fun, make a cheap, you know, schlocky genre exercise. But then in terms of like working together, I think our what you'd say our sensibilities sort of merged nicely, in the sense of like I like you know, like Guy Madden stuff and things like that, and sort of a little bit goofier comedy stuff, and Matt really kind of digs into the more genre elements of that kind of thing, and I think those kind of things merged together nicely. And then on set, it was just sort of I was kind of handling technical stuff, and Matt was working more with you know, Suzanne and Najara and Graham, and making all that stuff go.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I couldn't have said it better. I think we have a similar sense of humor and similar sensibilities, and then the differences in the kind of movies we gravitate toward. I mean, I like Guy Madden as well, but I think the things we're really drawn to are slightly different, and when you merge them, that's kind of what you get with this. Also, mm-hmm. Initially, you know, when JD, the producer I was talking about earlier, approached, you know, asked us to do this, it was originally Mike directing, but because of our schedules, it kind of made sense to split everything up too, just on from a practical standpoint, splitting all of the key jobs to get it done in that amount of time made sense. Mm-hmm.
So, And so when you guys were given the 5 weeks to write, you know, to make this movie, and you decided to sit down and do a script and everything. So what was the idea behind the story? How did you guys come up with the, what happens in this and everything? What was the inspiration?
That's such a long, I mean, excuse me. it was just kind of a mad scramble of ideas. The one thing we had to do was call it Dementia Part 2, I think was the only rule, right? And so there were ideas being thrown at us by Boulder Light Pictures, the production company. And then Mike and I were kind of in that week of writing, whatever it was, we were tossing around a lot of ideas. And the one that seemed to keep sticking was door to door, that's kind of a salesman kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it started to veer toward the salesman, and then somehow it was like the salesman and dementia kind of merged. But also at one point it was a road movie.
Yeah, I came up with a road movie. The practicality really led the cart again, because it was like, well, what can we do quickly?
Yeah, one location kind of thing.
Yeah, one location. So one of the ideas I had was a road movie where it was two people in a car. Like a Uber driver picks somebody up and then bad things happen. You know?
Oh, God.
Just like contained locations. And the one that we seem to keep coming back to, I guess we came up with three or four contained location ideas. And the one that we came back to the most, and that we were getting the most ideas from our producers on as well, was this, ex-con or salesman, whoever he is, going. At first it was door to door.
Yeah, it was a series of doors he was going to go to. And then we narrowed that.
A bunch of houses. Yeah. And it was like, well, where are we going to get a street? You know, how can we get a street on this budget and in this amount of time? And so then it became one house and a handyman job. And it was like, okay. And of all the characters in the street version, the old woman seemed the most interesting. So that's what we went with.
Where did you end up finding a house for this?
Well, that was tough. Again, because of the speedy pre-production, and I think we put everything together in about a week, I started looking for locations, and I found I went on Airbnb first, and that's really hard in Los Angeles where we are, because they're all wise to film, and they will not let you, you know.
Oh, that's fascinating. You don't even think about that, but they're probably looking out for that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like a regular location fee on a house, you're going to pay at least a couple $1,000s a day, if not, especially the kind of house we got for this, $5,000 a day for that kind of place.
Jeez.
Yeah, I mean, it can get that steep. So I went on Airbnb, and I was very honest with everybody I was calling. And, you get a yes out of every 15 people when you tell them you're going to shoot something. But I did get this guy who was like, yeah, that's fine. You know, we're just getting into the Airbnb game. We just renovated our place, and we don't mind if you shoot. I mean, it was like he had just moved to LA from Nebraska. You know? It was like, so Hollywood's knocking at my door. So he agreed to it, and it was like, great. And everything was great. And a few days went by, and it was the day before shooting, and I got I get a call from the guy, and he goes, so everything's still good. It's great. You're shooting, days, and we're all set. One thing, on Tuesday, I'm going to be jackhammering the sidewalk. I'm going to be renovating the front yard. And that's going to go on all day, but it's outside. That won't affect anything, right? And you're like, oh my God. we can't use this location.
And this was the Friday before the Sunday start, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Saturday before the Sunday start. I think it was the day before, I think. Yeah, it was either the day before or 2 days before. So I went into panic mode. Mike was away on a shooting a commercial in the Bahamas or something. And I'm like, oh my God. Yeah. So I called, the only thing I could think of. I had one other Airbnb option that wasn't great. The house just was tiny. And I the only option I had was, I have a friend, my buddy Rob, had recently bought a house, a fixer-upper in Koreatown here in LA. And it was a really nice craftsman house. And I called him, and it was kind of like how I, like with Graham, when I was talking about Graham getting the script the day before earlier, I called Rob and I said, hey, I'm shooting a movie, and really your house is just perfect. Cause it's this, I mean, it's the one in the movie. It's a really gorgeous craftsman house. Mm-hmm. And I called him and I said, I know you don't like shooting in your play. You don't want to shoot in your place, but can, you know, this movie's very low key. It's a very small crew. It's only like 5-6 people at a time there. Can we shoot in your place? And I can even give you, you know, I'll give you a location fee, which is probably the biggest thing we paid for in the budget. And it wasn't a lot. He didn't charge me a lot. It wasn't like I paid an arm and a leg, but I said, can we shoot there? He said, yeah. And he said, when do you start? I was like, can we come in at like 8 a.m. tomorrow to look at it? No, to start shooting. And he's like, oh. he sighed like a character in a cartoon. He's like, okay. And so it was like, I promise we'll keep treat everything. Just, you know, we won't damage anything. It'll be fine. Cue cut to us coming in the next day with barrels of Hershey's syrup.
Wow.
I mean, just, yeah. So it was a friend. Look, God, that was a long story short, a friend's house.
Wow.
It was a save job.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he's going to be like, you owe me every time you run into that.
Sure. Yeah, I remember we actually did manage to keep the place pretty clean and didn't, you know, damage anything because it was a pretty, you know, very small operation. But mm-hmm. he did call me. He's like, about 6 months later, and he's a very clean, right? I don't want to say compulsive, but he's a very clean guy. Yeah. And mm-hmm. 6 months later, he called me and said, he took a picture of a red dot on the wall above like a chandelier. Yeah, it was on the ceiling from the scene where Suzanne spit on my face. And there was somehow Suzanne had spit so hard and the ceiling was so high in that house.
Wow.
It got on the ceiling above the chandelier and he sent me a picture of it. And I was like, what is this? And he's like, that's blood. And I was like, I mean, it was microscopic. But
right. You guys got a pretty good soundtrack in this thing, didn't you? You got some good music on this. It's kind of got an 80s feel to it and everything. Tell me how you got that going.
Yeah, I a friend of mine who works at Monkey Paw Production, Jordan Peele's company. I was looking for I work with this composer Steve Moore a lot on my stuff, and we had no money, number one. And also he just wasn't right. available. So I had reached out to friends just looking for a composer.
Not that Steve Moore was demanding money.
Yeah. No, let's be clear. Yeah. But you know, we didn't have a huge budget. And so I was looking for, I was reaching out to friends. Mike was reaching out to friends looking for a composer who was, you know, maybe looking for a way to break in and do their first project. And, a friend of mine who works at Monkey Paw suggested this guy, David Lobovich, who I'd never met. And I met up with him and he is a composer and a songwriter and had done a lot of work, but it hadn't done a feature yet and had always wanted to. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about it and I send him a screener and, you know, the temp score, much like the score in the movie, is all over the map. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I'd tempt it with Harry Manfredini and Jerry Goldsmith and John Carpenter. I mean, just all over, which made sense for the movie. And he got really excited, which was a good sign because most composers, I feel like most composers would be like, what is this?
Right.
Do you know what you're doing?
Yeah.
But he got really excited. And, you know, when you're working with someone new, you never know what to expect. But he did an amazing job. And I wish, you know, we could have paid him more, but the budget was so low, we couldn't do much. But it was an amazing, basically, meeting and discovery of a new talent. Yeah. I mean, he was great and a new person. I can't wait to work with him.
So fast.
Crazy fast, obviously. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and the Harry Nelson bit, he was able to help us out there.
Yeah, because we attempt the montage in the middle with the work stuff, all the handiwork. Montage in the middle. We attempt that with Lime and the Coconut.
Oh yeah.
And he came. Yeah, David wrote a song. He wrote a song about a guy losing his fingers to the mob boss, and that the tone of it. It's a one chord islandy sounding song, and it just fit. It was great. Fit perfectly.
Yeah.
But he really, you know, replaced the temp with stuff that had the same tone, but also was very original. Mm-hmm. It's its own mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did, that's who did the music. And I didn't know him prior to it. And we became fast friends and he was very, facile, you know, really great.
Mm-hmm. Is there a, you know, this movie clocks in at 67 minutes. Is there anything that was actually left on the cutting room floor that did you not? So you used everything.
Yep. You're seeing everything we shot. Yeah.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah. There
it's
was
like a 1-to-1 shooting ratio.
Just mm-hmm. about. I mean, that's how fast we had to do it. We had to be, you know, the whole going into it, we decided no more than three, unless it was a scenario like an attack scene or a effects scene. We kind of went into it like every scene we get three setups and at most three takes, I think, is the rule. Yeah. I mean, and then we mm-hmm. have to move on. So it really was about, I mean, at most a 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 ratio.
And yeah, we kept to that pretty closely, except for like an audio issue. Mm-hmm.
And principal photography was 4 days. And then the fifth day we did after we'd cut stuff and knew if we needed where we needed more, and we went and shot more.
Yeah.
You know, after you've done this, obviously this is a breakneck pace and should never be replicated. But do you find like there's ways to trim fat off of your productions that you've done since and working into the future?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would love to not this pace necessarily, but I would love to try to, approach this again in a more conservative manner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a lesson for both of us and how fast you can really work and how simply you can try to approach your shoot days and your, you know, your script and your coverage and all that kind of stuff. I mean, would we love to have more time and more coverage and you know, him and
more money
for different things,
more money,
yeah, yeah. Of course, but you know, it was a great exercise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause before this, whether we've been directing or not, we've been in scenarios where there's been less or mm-hmm. well, almost always more money than this, but you know, bigger and smaller budgets. Right. And I think this one was, you know, when the idea first came up, I was resistant cause it seemed like a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
But the exercise at the end of the day was so rewarding because like Mike said, you get, you realize how much you can stretch simple coverage.
Right.
You know, I mean, it really, it was a great exercise in learning economy of shooting and how much you can get away with in a day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Have you guys ever done a 24-hour film festival thing?
I did that once. I did a 48-hour. And that was interesting. I mean, that, you know, sort of the same kind of deal. But I never got anything satisfactory out of that.
Right.
You guys are gluttons for punishment, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, like the whole thing seems like to be to me, you watch these movies and you're like, well, you see, if we had had like an extra couple of weeks, we could have done this. You know, that's what those festivals seem like. But I guess you learn some things from those if you ever enter them, like just, you know, some just basic things.
I think what you see in there, like what at least in my experience with the one time I did it, is that people try to do too much.
Mm hmm.
You know, they're trying to add special effects. They're trying to make this sort of legitimate short film with all the, you know, all details that should be kind of glossed over in that sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So after you've shot this movie and you've edited it and everything, you enter it into this festival. What was the reception like for it?
It seemed really positive. You know, We literally finished it. I think I exported the final, our in quotes final version as I was getting on the plane. I mean, we were flying to Chicago to show it, and they had, like, you know, they kept their word. They promised to show whatever we made. And the reaction, I remember it was a Monday or Tuesday. It was an off night. It was the last night of the festival, I think. And it was an off night. It was a weekday night. So the audience wasn't huge. There were maybe 20, 25 people at that first screening. But Brad Miska was there from mm-hmm. Bloody Disgusting. Simon Barrett, the writer Simon Barrett, was there because he was kind of hosting mm-hmm. the festival.
We just talked to Simon Barrett.
Yeah. Oh, really? For Seance?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
But they were both like, what? Yeah. How did you do that? So the reaction was very positive mm-hmm. At first. It seemed like the 20 or 25 people in the audience were laughing a lot. Yeah. And then we started getting into more festivals and getting bigger audiences in there. And it was positive. I think people feel the speed and fun it was made with, even though it's, I hope, competent. Yeah. it's a minor miracle how it turned out. I mean, and some of that could be attributed to what the skills we've acquired over the years, but also some of it isn't. I mean, it's like a confluence of like perfect, you know, a talented cast and little miracles happening. But the reaction, I think, comes from that. I think people feel that in it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you hoping that this sort of becomes a midnight staple, or do you have any like hopes for that, or what's your your ultimate goal with this movie now that it's finally getting a release?
Gosh. Yeah, I think so.
I think it plays well in that sense. I mean, it's just so, easy, I think. I mean, there's nothing that takes itself too seriously.
Yeah, I think mm-hmm. It's not like we went into it aiming for cult status.
Uh-huh. Right, right.
Here we go. But I think
welcome to Midnight Madness.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think if it turned out that way, like if people were like, if by word of mouth people were telling other people about, you have to see this ridiculous thing, that'd be great.
Yeah.
And I think it was sort of unavoidable because of the way it was made to have some of that vibe, you know? I mean, there's plenty of things in the movie that were missed. Lots of, again, minor instances of luck and miracles, like little things that would happen. Like, Suzanne would do little things. Again, going back to this, the spit in the face, that's the kind of thing you couldn't get right if you tried 50 times on a budgeted movie.
Right.
That would take half a day. Yeah. I mean, usually you'd use some kind of a Hudson spray or something with a pneumatic, like a mini guac gun to shoot with that. Just spit in my face. She just projectile spit. She put syrup in her mouth and spit in her face.
All those years of being angry at Matt Mercer.
Finally.
Yeah. There really isn't anything like being in a scene like that, though, as someone who, you know, I've known Suzanne for a while. Not that well, though. And like
not well enough for her to spit in your face.
Yeah, spit in my face or have oatmeal. You know, we're going to put oatmeal on your face and I'm going to do CPR.
Yeah, day one.
And we're going to be mouth to mouth. That was day one. That was the first thing we shot.
My God, really?
So we had to really trust each other. But luckily, we were all very comfortable with each other. I mean, Graham, I've worked with a bunch as an actor on like Joe Bigas's movies. And I mean, in Beyond the Gates, we've done a bunch together. And then Najara, I think.
I've worked with Najara like 100 times.
Yeah. I think we both worked with Najara on probably 20 movies between us. So yeah, we all just know each other really well. So that makes things a lot easier.
I love her performance too, because you never know where she's coming from for the longest time. You're just like, oh my God, is he even imagining this person? Right. I hope for the best on this one, man. I hope, you get a good cult following on this one.
Thanks.
Because this movie's a lot of fun. Barrett, do you have anything you might want to ask before we sign off?
Well, I know that this came out, at the festival several years ago. But what do you guys have coming up after this?
We're both actually working on a movie right now that we've been threatened. We can't talk about.
Oh, wow.
Sworn to secrecy.
That kind of party.
That kind of, yeah, yeah. We'll get murdered. But Mike is, we're not directing. I'm acting in it and doing some producing, and Mike is the cinematographer.
Oh, you just said too much now.
There's a knock on the, suddenly you just hear a silencer go off. It's just yeah. Yeah. Just a silencer
hits on the floor.
I wish I had a sound effects console in front of me. And I could just we could just make it seem like you heard our murders.
That would be the perfect end of this interview.
It'd be me and Barrett going, "What do you think happened?" I don't know.
It's like the guy standing in the corner of the basement in the Blair Witch Project.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly it.
I always think that's amazing that there's we're making movies here and people are like, you can't say anything about it. But, you know.
Well, normally we would, but this one, the director of this is like really hell bent on it being under the radar and just kind of being like, ha-ha, here it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah,
well, good luck, though.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah. We have irons in the fire, I guess.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one thing I was going to say. You guys seem to keep busy. Like, seems like there's constantly motion and movement and ideas and stuff like that. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we like to keep the fires burning and stay busy. I don't know. What's the old adage? Like, you stop and you die. That's not that's the expression at
all. That's the attitude. Stop and you die.
It's like a shark. The shark. Yeah.
There you go. That's it. The shark thing.
Yeah. Stop whatever. It's a shark thing. Whatever.
I know. I just distilled that into the dumbest. That's not at all a saying. You stop. What's the old saying? You stop, you die.
It's a saying. Yeah,
exactly. I love it, man.
Yeah, that exactly.
Like the tagline for rest stop.
Or speed 3.
Speed stop.
The movie is Dementia Part 2. It comes out in theaters May 21st. What theaters are we talking about here? What cities?
Oh god.
Yeah, I'm not
super
sure.
Limited. Yeah, we don't even have the full list yet, but I know it's LA and New York right now.
Okay. Is there a website that people can go to if they want to see it?
The Dark Star Pictures website usually has the information, but I think, most people are probably going to be able to see it on VOD and Blu-ray. I will say the Blu-ray is going to be awesome. We're putting a lot of features on there we've been working on, so that'll be fun.
Yeah.
No deleted scenes, though.
Nope.
No.
But it'll be in theaters May 21st and VOD, digital DVD, June 1st. Matt Mercer, Mike Teston, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. This was a blast. You guys are awesome.
We'd like to thank Matt Mercer and Mike Teston for their time. That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkins and Barrett Scher. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.